Chapter 15. So how could devious Ronnie Richardson, with trim Tessamare by his side, be zipping across Lago Maggiore in his raffish little motorboat? Bex had seen him lying dead in his own blood only an hour or so before. So how did he manage this resurrection? Indeed, Ronnie's life was unravelling, though far from over. To understand all the twists, turns, and coincidences, we must move down two snakes, as Charlie might have said, meaning go back a couple of days. We're at the guest house in Bern on that inclement evening when Tessa Murray arrived from Dublin with Bex on her tail. Tessa has had dinner and returned to her room. Soaking in her bath, with warm water lapping at her nipples, and a glass of Moet and Chandon at her lips, she thinks of the young woman she had more than noticed on the flight from Dublin, the one in the stylish belted raincoat, with an Hermes scarf pixie hooded around her head. Tex had seen her before, all right, clocked her, as the Argo had it, in drenching rain that morning up Grafton Street, marked her and noted her, now knowing that she was not there by chance, knowing also that she was the enemy. In the years that had followed her recruitment by Jimmy McLean, Tessa had become what she liked to call one of the sharpest knaves on the street. Pause for four beats before she always added, next to our man, of course. She'd learned nearly all she knew from our man, from Alchemist, who virtually took over her life from their first meeting, which was in Venice, of all places. Early on, McLean had told her their principal needed to see her, probably meet her as well. He told her where she was to go, ordered her not to deviate from the instructions he gave her. Should he wish to talk with her, Alchemist would make himself known. Of course, at that time they didn't call him Alchemist. If anyone is interested, they referred to him as Greeper, as in Grim Reaper. Tessa was to arrive in Venice on a Monday, and a room would be reserved for her at Ca' Foscari, in the tiny Calle della Frescada. "You've been to Venice?" Jim asked. "Never." "Oh, how I envy you. The first time with all that light." It was a week after Easter, in a mild spring, when the city was just starting to fill up, though not yet unbearably. On the Tuesday morning she was ordered to go to a tiny café, almost opposite the Stock Exchange, carrying a copy of Un Ospite di Venezia. She had to arrive at exactly 20 past midday, and wait until a table for two became available. She would order coffee, then wait for exactly half an hour. If nobody made contact, she had to leave, but go through the same procedure over three consecutive days. If by then nobody had approached her, Tessa was to return to Ireland. McLean also gave her an empty matchbook from the Cipriani, torn irregularly in half. Her contact would offer the matching half as his bona fides. It wasn't exactly James Bond stuff, but what is in real life? Later, Tessa would admit to having been dazzled by the time and place. The scent of Venice had not yet reached the ripeness of summer, but the tourists were already out in force, and the young men from the Stock Exchange, shirt-sleeved and Gucci-shoed, leaned against the wall across from the café, and stripped passing women with their eyes. On that first day, Alchemist arrived just as Tess was preparing to leave. Afterwards she realized that she'd seen him walk past some 10 minutes earlier, looking steadily at her. Tall, fit, slim, languid, in jeans and a denim jacket over a chambray shirt, his face tanned in a way that made her think not of beaches, but of ski slopes. An understated toughness about him immediately made you feel safe. This, of course, was one of his biggest assets, and one he worked at and embellished. "You're just going?" he asked, leaning forward to air-kiss her on both cheeks, as though they were old friends. Tess caught a whiff of expensive cologne, and thought of a night years before when she'd allowed a wealthy young client to take her in a Dublin hotel. She remembered putting a hand behind his ear and being put off by the roughness of his skin, which seemed to contrast violently with the scent of the cologne. "Stay while I have coffee." Richardson smiled and wrapped her up with his eyes. It was more of an instruction than a query, and as he spoke he slid the other half of the matchbook toward her across the table. It was as though a charge of electricity passed between them. When she thought about it, this was not completely accurate, too much of a clichéd thought. What travelled from one to the other was not so much static as an almost tactile sense of power. She found it both stimulating and almost physically overwhelming, as though her body had been taken over by some delicious nerve gas, a benign poison that removed free will. She would come to think of it as enthralling her, shackling her to Richardson. She would tell nobody, not even McLean, how she felt, nor what had happened. In a way, she hardly even admitted it to herself in the beginning, for she felt guilty and a little ashamed. The truth remained, Ron Richardson had an immediate effect on her. When she thought about it years later, she realized that it was similar to the way she had reacted to the young docking, but there was no testing period, no fencing with words to discover this man. He was immediately revealed to her as a person with great power, and he knew by instinct that she had almost instantly been aroused. Before the day was out, he was making love to her with a vigor she'd experienced only once previously. It was like a drug, and it held her captive across all her years. At that first meeting, he casually handed her an airline ticket and told her the flight left at 4 that afternoon. He would meet her on the plane, and they would travel together. She agreed instantly, without even looking at the destination on the ticket. Only after she'd checked out of the hotel and was in the water taxi bouncing across the lagoon toward Marco Polo Airport, did she drag the ticket out and see that she was heading for Geneva. That night, in the suffocating heaviness of a Swiss 5-star hotel, they forged the link that was to bind them together for the rest of their lives.
"Calvin has a lot to answer for," she told Richardson after the first bout of lovemaking.
And then he revealed a terrible gap in his knowledge by missing the point by several hundred years. Thinking she was talking about a strip cartoon character. Calvin, a small boy with his stuffed tiger called Hobbes. Instead of Geneva's great religious leader, John Calvin. She never referred to it again, her unnumbered senses signalling his lack of humour when it came to the gaping holes in his education. Achilles had his heel, and Ronnie had his patchy knowledge. In the end, Tessa's intuition led Ronnie Richardson to accept her as his main link to the real world. In the early days, Jim McLean had spelled out the danger, carefully revealing the risks and the morality of working for a professional murderer. Never once did McLean try to dissemble by cloaking the reality with political language. For instance, he never referred to Richardson as an assassin. He's a man who's not bothered by the ethics of life and death. McLean told her, when first explaining the concept of what Richardson viewed as his career. Some might imagine him to be a monster, but he's certainly not that. I don't think he takes any pleasure or delight in killing. He's simply not as other men. To him, there is no moral issue. He views it merely as his job.
He must be able to differentiate between right and wrong.
Probably, but not necessarily, McLean told her. Somehow he seems to avoid the moral issues entirely. And that was how it was. An acceptance of him for what he was, and the deep animal need that passed between them like a stab of lightning. Tessa Murray and Ronnie Richardson, she thought, now and forever, like the ads for a long-running musical. With the thought came an unbidden picture of some unspecified retirement cottage. Chocolate box art, with roses round the door, everything she did not want. As she lay in her bath in the Bairn Hotel on that night when she arrived with Bex riding in her slipstream, Tessa relived what had followed her first meeting with Alchemist, how he had patiently taught her what he called the field craft of death. Over 3 weeks they'd moved from Geneva back to Venice, then to Paris and London, eventually ending up in his secret villa, at that time on the shores of Lake Lucerne. 2 years later, following a concern that the Lucerne place had been compromised, he bought another house, the Villa Mirta, close to Brissago, on Lake Maggiore. The evergreen myrtle grows in abundance along the shores of Lake Maggiore.